Hello and welcome. You're listening to me, Alice, on the Backtracker History Show podcast. Join me as we go delving through the archives to find out about people, places and events that happened in the past. These were stories that were big news in their day, but are largely forgotten now. Most of these podcasts have been specially edited from a Bradley Stoke radio show in Bristol, England. And one of the great things about this podcast is that I can go into more detail about each story because there are no time constraints. And it's really easy to show your support just by spreading the word, leaving reviews, and sharing with all your family and friends. It really does help. If you want to get in touch with me with show ideas, comments, or information, you can via Twitter or Facebook by using @BacktrackerUK with a capital B, capital T and a capital UK, or emailing me at info@backtracker.co.uk. Now, on with the show. Today we'll be venturing back to 1684 and the Stuart era of the English monarchy. But what else happened back then? Well, on the 15th of January, to demonstrate that the River Thames, frozen solid during the great frost that started in December, was safe to walk on, a coach and six horses drove over the Thames for a bet. And within 3 days, whole streets of booths were built on the Thames and thousands of people were continually walking on it. On the 7th of June, after a siege of 6 weeks that began on April the 27th, Luxembourg City was taken over by the French army from control of Spain, and the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, previously part of the Spanish Netherlands, now Belgium, was acquired by the French. On the 23rd of October, English King Charles II revokes the Massachusetts Bay Colony Charter due to repeated violations of the Charter's terms, including trading with other countries and running an illegal mint. And also that year, the British East India Company receives Chinese permission to build a trading station at Canton. Tea sells in Europe for less than a shilling a pound, but the import duty of 5 shillings makes it too expensive for most English people to afford. Hence, smuggled tea is drunk much more than legally imported tea. But the event we'll be talking about this week occurred during the month of April, when a Bristolian linen trader was discovered to be involved in a case of treason. To start off with, let me tell you a little bit about James Holloway, the Bristolian linen draper and iconoclast, who, when the importation of linen from France was forbidden, tried to improve the production of English linen. In 1679, he tried to persuade the Bristol Chamber to help him to carry out his scheme in the city, offering to employ Bristol people only and to find steady work for 500 of them. On the 8th of May, the Chamber agreed to his proposals and decided to erect a workhouse for the purpose at the east end of the Bridewell. A letter, however, was sent to them on the 25th by Sir John Knight, alderman, and one of the members of Parliament of the city, pointing out that the prohibition of French linens would terminate in March 1681, just 2 years later. And so Holloway then went to London to advocate his plan. In his voluntary confession and narrative, written with his own hand and delivered by himself to Secretary Jenkins, Holloway says,
"I observed a great dissatisfaction in people in most parts where I travelled, but I heard nothing of any design until July 1682, when one Mr. Joseph Tiley of Bristol came from London. At a meeting with him, asked him what news, and he answered to his effect, all bad, and if some speedy course not be taken, we shall all be undone."
This was the first indication for Holloway that the country was very unsettled and the people were starting to think about taking control. In 1680, Holloway met the Earl of Essex, who introduced him to Lawrence Hyde, the head of the Treasury. Hyde encouraged him to come to London during the next session of Parliament, where he displayed his goods. He also visited Oxford during Parliament sessions and was asked by Lord Clarendon to draft a bill on linen manufacture. It's worth noting that it was 20 years after the restoration of the Stuart monarchy, and King Charles II and his wife, Catherine of Braganza, had still not managed to have a child. But his Catholic brother's second marriage to Mary of Medina increased the possibility of the Catholic line of succession, for James's conversion to the Roman Church was well known. And so many plots began to surface, like the Popish plot of 1678, when allegations by Titus Oates, a former Anglican cleric, that the Roman Catholics planned to murder Charles to make James king, caused Charles to nearly lose control of his government. In the end, Charles had to allow the Earl of Shaftesbury and his Whig supporters to uphold the power of Parliament, even though he couldn't stand them. There were three general elections, which produced three terrible parliaments, and Charles publicly denied that the Protestant Duke of Monmouth was his first son. In the end, in a desperate bid to save his throne, he sent his Catholic brother James out of the country, with limitations to his power. This plan proved to be unacceptable, both to the Whigs and to James. And when Charles fell seriously ill in the summer of 1679, there was a real danger of civil conflict. And so the scene was set for the Whigs to start a new plot, the Rye House Plot, in a bid to get rid of Charles II for good.
Word of the Week.
Considering the theme of this week's show, the word I give you is treason, which is a betraying of trust, a breach of faith, from the Anglo-French trahison, and from the Latin traditionem, which meant delivery, surrender, and handing down or giving up. This word first came into existence in the 1200s. Whilst visiting London and Oxford to promote his ideas, Holloway became involved in the exclusion crisis. In the summer of 1682, he participated in a plot against the government following the election of Tory sheriffs in London. The plot aimed to organise a rebellion in London and other cities by assassinating King Charles II and his brother, James, Duke of York, and encourage a subsequent uprising, removing Roman Catholic councillors from power and secure the succession of the Duke of Monmouth, an illegitimate son of Charles II and Lucy Walter. Born in 1649, the Duke of Monmouth was raised by Lord Croft and made Duke of Monmouth in 1663, and he later went on to marry the wealthy Anne, Countess of Buccleuch. Now, this was a time when the country was in so much upheaval that even the plotters couldn't decide amongst themselves what exactly they wanted. Some of the Whigs wanted a republic, and some wanted the Duke of Monmouth as their king. This particular plot was initiated by radical members of the English Whig Party. The Whigs were predecessors of today's Liberal Democrats, and were initially formed to oppose the succession of James, a Roman Catholic. Broadly speaking, they favoured a monarchy with limited powers. And the perfect spot to initiate their plan became the name of the plan, Rye House, which is located northeast of Hoddesdon, Hertfordshire. It was a fortified medieval mansion surrounded by a moat and owned by Republican and Civil War veteran Richard Rumbold, who was implicated with Lord Shaftesbury, the Earl of Essex, and the Earl of Bedford. March and April of 1683, Holloway was in London making arrangements with Nathaniel Wade, another Bristolian, and was told about the Rye House plot against the King and the Duke of York. Although he didn't really agree with the plot, he associated with those promoting it. He met with Robert Ferguson and discussed the plot, claiming only a few people in Bristol were involved. He planned to secure Bristol without violence and led the effort in Bristol with 350 men. The King and Duke of York were not very well respected, to be honest, and were known by various nicknames like slavery and popery. Some more personal nicknames were basically insults after their complexions. Charles was dark and called Blackbird, while James, Duke of York, was fair and called Goldfinch. There were several suggestions how they might be killed, but eventually the conspirators met at Rye House, near Hoddesdon in Hertfordshire, to make their final plans. Near to Rye House ran a narrow lane that was regularly used by the King when he went to Newmarket. Along it was a thick hedge on one side, and on the other an outhouse that was perfect for hiding behind and a good vantage point for the assassins. And so the royal party went from Westminster to Newmarket to see the horse races, and were expected to make the return journey on April the 1st, 1683. But because there was a major fire in Newmarket on the 22nd of March, which destroyed half the town, the races were cancelled, and the King and Duke returned to London early, and the plot was foiled.
Word on the street.
Today we're travelling to Gingell's Green in St George, named after George Gingell, who was a hay and straw salesman trading from this spot in the 1880s. His family would later become known for their butcher trade and ran a popular shop in Lawrence Hill up until the 1980s. News of the failed plot leaked when Josiah Keeling spoke to Sir Llewellyn Jenkins, and the plot was publicly discovered on the 12th of June, 1683. Keeling had contacted a courtier who had put him in touch with George Legg, 1st Baron of Dartmouth, and Dartmouth had brought him to Jenkins, Secretary of State. Keeling's testimony was used at the trials of Walcott, Hone, Sidney and Charles Bateman, and it heard him, earning him, a fellow conspirator, a pardon. Using his brother, Keeling was able to get more evidence of conspiracy, and Jenkins brought it to Colonel John Rumsey and Robert West, who saved their lives by turning King's evidence against other conspirators. 12 of those were convicted and executed, most of whom were hung, drawn and quartered. Yet another man turned evidence against his conspirators, Robert West, who detailed the Rye House plot and his part in purchasing arms, supposedly for America. He received his pardon in December 1684. After the failed plot and in early May, James Holloway returned to London, but by then he was facing financial difficulties. And after learning of the discovery of the plot in June, he left Bristol and travelled as a wool dealer in Gloucestershire, Oxfordshire and Somerset. He was charged with high treason, outlawed for not appearing in court, and later indicted by a grand jury in August. He secretly returned to Bristol and arranged passage for himself to France and the West Indies, disguising himself as a merchant called John Millward, selling brandy. He sailed on the 23rd of July and arrived at Barbados on the 11th of November, but his friend on Nevis betrayed him, and he was arrested on the island of St. Eustatius, sent home in irons and confined in Newgate Prison. And so James Holloway appeared before the King's Bench and apologised for not being in court for his initial hearing. Chief Justice Jeffreys said,
"Yes, you have been absent so long, it seems, that you now stand outlawed and thereby attained of high treason. There is no thing now remains with the court but only to make a rule for your execution."
James Holloway was refused a trial and was sentenced to execution. In April 1684, Holloway confessed to Sir Leoline Jenkins. After telling his side of the story, he made a plea to the king.
"Now, if your majesty is greatly pleased to spare me, it will be a sufficient warning to me forever, meddling in things of that nature again. And I hope I shall have the opportunity of serving your majesty and my country in the promotion of that which brought me into this, and cost me many hundreds of pounds with some years of pains to bring it to that perfection I did. The linen manufacture, which many honourable persons about your court have heard of, and I can make it appear that it will employ nearly 80,000 poor people and 40,000 acres of land, and bring in and save your majesty nearly £200,000 per annum."
Later, when asked if he had anything to say to clear his conscience, Holloway said,
"I thank God I never had any design against his majesty's person. What I intended was only for the good of the king and the kingdom, and I did take it that it would have been so. And I'm very sorry that any things should have been contrary to the law, as they have done, and I hope care will be taken to prevent any such things for the future."
After telling Holloway that he didn't have long to live, Sheriff Dame opened his Bible and read the 62 Psalm and part of two chapters in Hebrews before asking the other sheriffs to pray with him. Only a few days later, Holloway was dragged by sled to Tyburn to be hanged until he was almost dead. He was then drawn and quartered, which means his penis and scrotum were removed. He was disemboweled, beheaded, and his limbs were cut off. Holloway's head and body were sent to Bristol with an order that the parts be prominently displayed over the main gates as a warning to others that any acts of treason would not be tolerated. Although the Act of Parliament defining high treason remains on the United Kingdom's statute books, during some legal reform in the 19th century, the sentence of hanging, drawing and quartering was changed to drawing and quartering until dead, and posthumous beheading and quartering before being abolished in England in 1870. The death penalty for treason was abolished only in 1998. There were several other Bristolians amongst the plotters. One of them was Colonel Rumsey, who, to save his own life, turned King's evidence. John Rowe was another. He was considered a weak man by the other plotters, who wanted to drown him in case he turned against them. In the end, they paid him off and sent him out of the way to Switzerland. There was Bristol doctor Ichabod Chauncey. He was originally from America and moved to England after studying in Harvard. Bristol seemed the best place to start a medical practice, and in 1670, he also joined the Castle Street Congregational Church. This was where he met Nathaniel Wade. Chauncey was harassed by government spies at the time, who assumed that his position in society would allow him to influence people in power in Bristol. He was even imprisoned if he didn't go to church. After the discovery of the Rye House plot, Chauncey fled to Holland and stayed there until he was pardoned in 1686. But the main Bristolian conspirator has to be Major Nathaniel Wade, a solicitor throughout the 1670s and 80s, along with his brother William, who was a grocer. They were very active members of the area's dissenters. Wade was a regular at London's Green Ribbon Club, an establishment frequented by the plotters. Once the plot was discovered, Wade found himself a wanted man with a very high bounty on his head, so he fled to Switzerland before he moved on to Holland to work for Charles's exiled illegitimate son, the Duke of Monmouth. Wade was still involved in the scheme to dethrone Charles II and put Monmouth on the throne, so when Monmouth landed at Lyme Regis, Wade was right there. Wade tried to encourage Monmouth that to stand any chance of dethroning his father, Monmouth had to secure Bristol, a strategic city ripe for a takeover. Monmouth, though, declined the idea, and so the opportunity was lost. There was then the disastrous battle at Sedmore, after which Wade ran to Ilfracombe. There he was shot and captured. The Duke of Monmouth, who had led the Battle of Sedmore on the 6th of July 1685, was captured and executed. Surprisingly, despite the fact he was a well-known troublemaker, Wade was permitted to turn King's evidence and made a full confession, whilst recovering from his bullet wound. Following Wade's pardon, he was appointed town clerk in Bristol and went on to found the Bristol Workhouse and Corporation for the Poor. In 1704, Wade became deputy governor and joined the Bristol Society for the Reformation of Manners, a group that discouraged swearing, debauchery and prostitution. Wade's last public act in Bristol was in 1709 when he led the militia against Kingswood miners who were rioting against high food prices. In this instance, there was only one woman executed, Elizabeth Gaunt, who was probably innocent and was burned at the stake. She was a woman of immense compassion and spent her days visiting prisoners in jail, and one of those happened to be James Burton, one of the Rye House conspirators. She managed to get him onto a boat bound for Gravesend, from which he travelled to the safety of Amsterdam. As he was leaving, she handed him a large sum of money to help him start afresh. Eventually, Burton returned to England after a while, with Monmouth and fought at Sedgemoor, before finding refuge at the house of John Fernley, a barber in Whitechapel, London. Fernley was very poor, with creditors visiting him regularly. He knew there was a reward for Burton, but couldn't at first betray someone who had sought safety under his roof. But in the end, it was Fernley himself who was betrayed. Once Burton realised that the king's anger towards those who harboured traitors was worse than that for the traitors themselves. The king had publicly declared that
of all forms of treason, the hiding of traitors from my vengeance is the most unpardonable.
And so, to save his own skin, Burton provided information against both Fernley the barber and Elizabeth Gaunt, who were put on trial with Burton as the main witness against them. Fernley was hanged, and Elizabeth was burnt at stake at Tyburn. Elizabeth had left a paper which was read by many thousands with compassion and horror.
My fault was one which a prince might have forgiven. I did but relieve a poor family, and lo, I must die for it.
On the day, William Penn rushed to the site of Elizabeth's execution and witnessed the whole event. He would later tell how he saw her calmly move the straw about her to help speed up her eventual end and shorten her suffering, as those watching burst into tears. As the fire burned, the weather turned into a foul tempest. Elizabeth was the last woman executed for any political offence.
Hey, this is Russ.
This is Kyle.
This is Michelle.
From the Infectious Groove Podcast.
Join us every Monday for the most fun you can have with a music podcast. The Infectious Groove Podcast uses a positive and fun approach as we take time every week to share our jammy jams, then dig into a thought-provoking topic discussing all decades and genres of music. You can find the Infectious Groove Podcast on all major podcast platforms, or you can head to infectiousgroovepodcast.com to find us there and subscribe. We might have a controversial opinion here or there, but we always have fun with it.
Oh, I'm sure I'll say something dumb.
Subscribe to the Infectious Groove Podcast, part of the Odd Pods Media Network.
In the news today, I told my doctor that I broke my arm in two places. He told me to stop going to those places.
Back in the day facts.
Okay, let's start with the 6th of April, 1772, when Catherine the Great, Empress of Russia, ends tax on men with beards, which was enacted by the Tsar Peter the Great in 1698. On the 7th of April, 1983, archaeologists unearth the skeleton of a man who lived 30,000 years ago in what is now Egypt. Analysis revealed that the man was between 17 and 29 years old when he died, stood approximately 5 foot 3 inches tall, and was of African ancestry. The skeleton is the oldest example of Homo sapiens remains found in Egypt and one of the oldest in the world. On the 8th of April 1820, the famous ancient Greek statue, Venus de Milo, is discovered on the Aegean island of Milos. Believed to depict Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, she has been displayed at the Louvre Museum since 1821. The 9th of April 2002 saw the funeral of Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, at Westminster Abbey. More than a million people lined the streets. The 10th of April 1633, and the first bananas go on sale in London, in the shop window of Thomas Johnson's apothecary. The 11th of April 1966, and Frank Sinatra records Strangers in the Night, the single for his album of the same name. Also on the 11th of April, but in 1976, the Apple I computer, created by Steve Wozniak, is released. The 12th of April 1926 sees Alfred Hitchcock releasing his first film as a director, Pleasure Garden, in England. The silent drama was actually made in Germany. And lastly, on the 13th of April 1666, John Dryden, aged 36, is appointed the first English Poet Laureate by King Charles II. Well, I'm afraid that's the end of this week's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it as interesting as I did. And, of course, I'd like to thank those who really brought today's story to life. And this week we had Marcus KP and Steve Shepherd from our very own Bradley Stoke Radio, as well as Joe Wilson and Sam Roberts from St. Stephen's Drama Group right here in Bristol. Thank you, one and all. Thank you once again for listening to me, Alice, on the Backtracker History Show. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can find me on Twitter or Facebook by looking up at Backtracker UK with a capital B, a capital T, and a capital UK. I also occasionally post onto TikTok and Instagram. So do come along and find me, because it's amazing to hear from you and get some feedback or even ideas for future shows. As a small independent podcaster, your help and support is always appreciated. And one way you can do that is to rate the show wherever you get your podcasts. Leaving a review also helps, as it gives other people an idea of what the show's about. The show is regularly released on Mondays. So until next time, guys, take care and look after each other.